Our next case this morning is numbers 052515 and 062672, General Auto Services against the City of Chicago. Mr. Baltz.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tom Baltz, and I represent General Auto and the other appellants, the plaintiffs in the district court. This case, of course, involves a dispute between plaintiffs in the City of Chicago over the legality of an advertising sign we will call the wall sign for purposes of this argument. The primary issues before this court are, first, whether the city's ordinance provision limiting the size and location of advertising signs in conjunction with the city's grandfather clause modifying that provision was applied to the wall sign in an arbitrary and irrational manner when legal nonconforming status was denied to the wall sign in April of 1998. Second.
Now, Mr. Baltz, let's do first.
Yes.
Why isn't it perfectly rational and appropriate for a city to grandfather, or okay, this city, to grandfather those nonconforming signs for which a permit was previously issued and those which were not? In other words, doesn't a city have a legitimate interest in regulating signs through a permit process and in giving more favorable treatment in terms of grandfathering to property owners who have complied with that process?
The city certainly has an interest, Your Honor, I grant this court that, in grandfathering certain signs. But in this instance, it's impermissible, and that's because plaintiffs proved at trial that the city confers legal nonconforming status to advertising signs based solely upon prior compliance with an unconstitutional sign permitting scheme. That, in and of itself, can never be rational and justified. And that leads into...
So, in other words, owners who comply with permit requirements don't have a greater reliance interest, even though they obtained express approval for their signs, and a city doesn't have a valid interest in encouraging people to comply with the permit process?
The city has a valid interest, but it cannot tie the grandfathering of signs to a permit scheme, which is an unconstitutional prior restraint of speech. And that's what the city has done in this instance. If you look at the signs permitting scheme, at least prior to 1998.
The city's ordinances have nothing to do with regulating speech. They have to do with regulating size and location of signs. There aren't any content restrictions in the ordinance.
This sign was precluded. This particular wall sign was precluded because of its commercial content. This sign was not allowed to remain because it violated Section 8.9, parenthetical 7, of the zoning ordinance dealing with advertising signs. What the city did in this instance was it precluded that sign, and because of its commercial content, and did not accord it the exception of the grandfather statute because there was no prior permit on file dating back to the 1960s, 1970s, and it is that tie-in to a previous sign permit and an unconstitutional sign permitting scheme that is not permissible and it is not rational.
Well, that raises a threshold question about whose claim this is, to the extent that a First Amendment claim is being asserted. As I understand it, it's not your sign, it's White Coast sign, or not your client's sign, it's White Coast sign. You represent the building owner.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Who leases the side of the building to the commercial entity which is doing the advertising. And so is there a threshold question of standing?
Well,
to assert the First Amendment claim? You're not the speaker here. Your client is not the speaker. Your client is the property owner.
I understand. There is there was an issue that was addressed. This was an issue that was addressed by the district court as well, and the district court had some concern over that very issue. In the district court's final judgment, the court remarked, quote, as for the city's discretion in deciding whether to issue permits for illuminated signs, plaintiffs did not qualify for a permit under the relevant zoning laws, and thus the district court likewise had some concern that the delay or discretion could not have violated plaintiffs' rights.
Well, you plaintiff, know, it may be true in hindsight, that the permitting process in the 1960s and 1970s had First Amendment problems. But why are any such problems relevant today in terms of the grandfather provision? Gas, as I understand it, never sought a permit. For all we know, it would have gotten a permit had it only asked for one, but it didn't bother asking. So I don't understand, and I hope you can help me, why Gas should be allowed to rely on such defects today.
I'm glad you asked that question, Your Honor. It's because the city of Chicago looks back to the prior permitting scheme in determining today grandfather status. It looks at when the sign was erected or altered in order to determine whether the sign will be given grandfather status. So when it makes a determination, when the city of Chicago makes a determination and says some signs will be grandfathered, other signs will not be grandfathered, it says the inquiry is, were you erected pursuant to a permit given to you by the city? Well, in this case, as in other cases, you're talking about going back to the 1960s and 1970s.
Well, I may be very obtuse in not quite getting it, but Gas never tried to obtain that permit in the 60s or 70s. So to me, it's not at all clear that any constitutional defects in the permitting process prejudiced Gas. And against that, isn't the city entitled to say, look, if you complied with our permit procedure back then and got a permit, we will let your sign remain in place today, even though it doesn't conform to our current rules. But you never got a permit when you had the chance. So we're not going to exempt your sign from current rules. I mean, that to me is, you know, kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, the Supreme Court in the decisions we have cited has made clear that when faced with an unconstitutional sign permitting scheme, because the sign permitting scheme constitutes an impermissible prior restraint of speech, a plaintiff, in order to have standing to make the claim, doesn't have to seek a permit. That's consistent with this court's decision in Southworth v. Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system, where it stated the Supreme Court has long held that when a licensing scheme vests unbridled discretion in a government official, a plaintiff has standing to facially challenge the regulation without applying for a license.
I thought you were making an as-applied challenge.
Yeah. Well,
part of your challenge is not a speech claim. It's a permit claim. It's a land use regulation claim.
It's an as-applied challenge, but it is also a facial challenge insofar as the city ties in prior compliance with an unconstitutional sign permitting scheme. So there are elements of both as-applied and facial in our claim.
It seems to me the whole First Amendment argument here is just sheer bootstrapping. What's happening is your sign may or may not have been legal when it was put up in the 60s. It was illegally enlarged. It was illegally illuminated. You needed a permit to enlarge it. You needed a permit to illuminate it. You didn't get either of those. And then when the city sought to enforce the new ordinance restricting size and location of these sorts of signs and gave you notice of that, you left it to your lessee to fight City Hall on that enforcement action. And then when your lessee lost, you cried foul and come forward with this First Amendment argument claiming that the underlying permitting scheme is a prior restraint in violation of the First Amendment. And you do it more than 2 years after you were given notice of the violation. So we have a whole lot of problems with this claim. And maybe what we should do is go back to the timeliness, because if the claims are untimely, then we don't get to the merits at all. So why don't you address the timeliness issue?
I will address the timeliness issue, but just to touch once again on the point you made, Your Honor, again, the city cannot look back today and say you didn't comply with our sign permitting scheme when that sign permitting scheme is unconstitutional on its face. With regard to the finding by the district court of a statute of limitations problem, the city did not rule that this particular sign did not have legal nonconforming status until April of 1998. That was well within 2 years of when plaintiffs brought their claims in the federal district court.
But the notice of the violation was served well beyond 2 years.
There was a notice of violation that you don't have a permit.
And you were told that the sign required one. So at that point, there was notice that the city was seeking enforcement of its ordinances and your constitutional claims, to the extent that they exist here, were implicated.
Yeah. Not having a permit and having a sign that is legal nonconforming are not the same thing. And, in fact, that's evidenced by the violation notice itself in 1997, which didn't say you don't have a permit, you need to take this sign down. The very language of the notice said obtain a permit. That was consistent with the subsequent administrative law finding saying, yes, we find you in violation of not having a permit. We're going to set this for 5 or 6 months from now, continue it, and allow you to mitigate this and apply for a permit. The city did this within the context of knowing that this sign did not currently comply with zoning. It had previously noticed the sign for not complying with Section 8.9, parenthetical 7, saying the sign is too big and too close an advertising sign to a residence district. And it was not until April 1998 when the city of Chicago, reversing the position it had taken in 1995, it had found this sign to be specifically legal nonconforming. In April of 1998, it took the position for the first time, reversing its prior position, that the sign was not legal nonconforming.
Well, it's my understanding that the 1995 proceeding was never concluded. There was a preliminary decision on the legal nonconforming status.
That's right. I'm glad you brought that up because it underscores the problem with the city's sign permitting scheme prior to the 1998 changes that were implemented by the city. In 1995, there was a two-step permitting process. You had to get zoning certification from the city that you complied with zoning or that your use was legal nonconforming. Our tenant did that. Part two, because this was a large advertising sign, you had to obtain an order from the City of Chicago Council, but there was no time limit within which the City Council had to act. The Supreme Court has recognized that in and of itself is an impermissible prior restraint, unconstitutional under the First Amendment, and that's exactly what happened in this case. We went in, the sign tenant's application went in front of the City Council. A letter was written to the alderman, Burton Nateris, and nothing happened. As the sign permitting scheme is written today, the city council has to act within, I believe it's 60 days. And if the city council does nothing, there's a default provision saying that it is considered that you get approval from the city council. This leads into the fact that the elements of a substantive due process claim were proved at trial. As this court noted, the elements of a substantive due process claim are that when a plaintiff's substantive due process claim is predicated on the deprivation of a state-created property interest, and that's what we're talking about. The state-created property interest in this case is the denial of legal nonconforming status. The state actor, there are two elements necessary. The state actor's conduct must be arbitrary and irrational, and the state actor must commit a separate constitutional violation or show that state law remedies are inadequate.
But if your sign was illegally enlarged and illegally illuminated, you don't have a property interest in an illegal sign.
That's true. Our contention is it was not illegally enlarged and it was not illegally illuminated. And let me explain that answer. At the time we enlarged, or the sign was enlarged, and at the time it was illuminated, that perfectly complied with the zoning ordinance. The only thing on the books, as far as the Chicago Code was concerned, that it did not comply with was obtaining a permit. The scheme, as written in the 1960s and 1970s, was facially invalid because there were no sufficient objective standards for the local official to issue any such permit, and the same applied for large signs in the second step where permits applications had to go in front of the city council. With regard to the first element, standard was first set out in the Koth v. Hartford Insurance case in 1988, that the state actor's conduct must be arbitrary and irrational. Plaintiffs met their burden, and as stated, that can be summarized insofar as the city confers legal nonconforming status to advertising signs based solely upon prior compliance to their unconstitutional sign permitting scheme.
That ordinance is not limited to advertising signs. The permit requirement pertains to all signs. The only ordinance, as I understand it, that's limited to advertising signs is the one that specifies that it has to be, it cannot exceed 100 square feet and cannot be within 250 feet of a residence district. I'm sorry, 75 feet of a residence district.
Our contention, Your Honor, is that it is the advertising sign provision, 8.9 parenthetical 7, as modified and directly applied to the grandfather clause. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Balz. We'll hear now from Ms. Layton.
May it please the court. Your Honors, General Auto illegally illuminated and enlarged its sign without a permit in violation of city ordinances. It now wants to claim perpetual grandfather status, which is a benefit that the city affords to signs that lawfully obtained permits. But General Auto brought its claims too late, and its suit is time-barred, and even if it were not, all three claims fail on their merits. With respect to the statute of limitations argument, General Auto knew at the latest, by September 1997, all the information it needed in order to bring its lawsuit.
Well, now, I have a bit of a question about that, because given that the zoning department had characterized the sign as a legal nonconforming use in 1994, couldn't Gass have thought that the city might eventually reach the same conclusion with respect to the 1997 notice of violation?
No, Your Honor. Of course, that's an argument for equitable tolling. But General Auto has never claimed that it, in fact, relied upon that determination as a reason to delay filing its lawsuit. In order for an equitable tolling or equitable estoppel to apply, General Auto would have to actually rely upon something that the city did as an affirmative act that was directed toward delaying them from filing their lawsuit. William Merritt's stamp that the sign was legally nonconforming in 1995 was an error. And the reliance by General Auto would have to be reasonable. In light of the clear language of the grandfather provision, which was on the books since 1990, General Auto could not have reasonably relied upon a stamp that said the sign was nonconforming in 1994. Moreover, it's never claimed that it did as a matter of fact. And even if it did, it would still have to bring its lawsuit in a timely manner. By 1997, General Auto knew, after the 1990 amendments, that its sign was not conforming with current zoning because it violated the distance requirement. It was too close to a residence district. It also knew in order to remain as a nonconforming sign, it needed to be afforded something called legal nonconforming status. That's what the grandfather provision did. The grandfather provision, which is a 1990 ordinance as well, said that the sign had to have a permit on file prior to the effective date of that ordinance.
Of course, legal nonconforming was what they thought they had back in 94, 95.
But even
when
the
official city stamp was affixed.
But even a stamp in 1994 or 1995 would not have entitled it to nonconforming status under the grandfather provision, which is the sole basis for their claim, because the grandfather provision says there must be a permit on file prior to the effective date of this ordinance. So in other words, before 1990. So a stamp in 1994 or 1995 that the sign is complying doesn't mean that there was in fact a permit on file prior to 1990. General Auto knew or surely should have known that its sign lacked a permit because it had been illegally illuminated and enlarged in the 1960s and 70s. So the William Merritt stamp, even if there was a basis to claim that they reasonably relied on it, which there isn't in light of the clear text of the ordinance. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm breathing.
Okay. So it knew the information it needed by then. At the absolute latest, if it didn't know it didn't have a permit before 1990, it surely knew that by September 1997, when its lessee, Whiteco, conceded as much, and the city entered a finding to that effect that it had not, that its sign had been illegally illuminated and enlarged. So it had all the information it needed well before it filed its lawsuit, well before 2 years before it filed its lawsuit.
So let me think. On the merits of the substantive due process claim, if we agreed with General Auto or Gas that the permitting process in the 60s and 70s was constitutionally flawed, then would it be appropriate for the city to rely on whether or not an owner got a permit during that time for purposes of the grandfather provision?
Well, Your Honor, even if this court agreed that the 60s and 70s permitting scheme was unconstitutional, General Auto still would not have a substantive due process claim because at most that would mean that the grandfather provision cannot constitutionally afford legal nonconforming status to permitted signs. But what is required to have a due process claim is a clear entitlement under state law. And the city has never clearly afforded nonconforming status, legal nonconforming status, to non-permanent signs. So strike out the grandfather provision. But all that means is that we can't afford the status to permitted signs. It doesn't rewrite the ordinance to create a clear entitlement under state law for non-permanent signs, since it's General Auto's.
I may have missed this somewhere along the way in the briefs, et cetera. How many such situations exist, or is this one of a kind?
Well, Your Honor, the record does not reflect exactly how many signs are in this situation, but I would say that there certainly at the very latest. It's been since 1970 that all signs have required permits. The district court found that all signs did not used to require permits prior to 1970. There was testimony that from one of our witnesses that, in fact, all signs have always required permits. But even if accept the district court's position that it wasn't until 1970 that all signs required permits, at the very least, for the past 30 or 40 years, all signs have required permits. So it's it's probably a rare case.
Is it still true that the final permitting authority is the Common Council?
Right now, the final permitting authority is the City Council under the current regime, and the Building Commissioner has to issue the permit so long as the City Council... I mean, if the City Council approves it, then it has to be issued. And if the City Council doesn't act, then it has to be issued as well. It has to... and there's a time limit for 75 days.
If I can change the focus just for a minute. With respect to the question of statute of limitations... Is it your view that that's only applicable with respect to the procedural due process matter?
No, Your Honor. It's our position that the statute of limitations argument applies for both the substantive due process and the procedural due process claim because the substantive due process claim as well, General Auto had the same facts at its disposal. What it's challenging, what its injury is claimed to be, is the application or the existence of these regulations as applied to its particular sign. And it knew all it needed to know in order to challenge these regulations, these restrictions, before September 1997.
In reading the briefs, I was concerned with what I viewed, at least, as a kind of an absolutist position on the applicability of the two-year statute of limitations when equitable relief is requested. Aren't there some situations where the statute would not apply and where the equitable doctrine of latches would?
Well, Your Honor, there is where the equitable relief under the statute is the sole remedy afforded. There is precedent to support the notion that latches rather than the statute of limitation applies. However, 1983 allows relief both in equity and in law. And so, therefore...
So you really advocate a position that, with respect to 1983 actions, the statute applies, period. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that going to be a little bit rough the next time somebody wants to bring, let's say, a school desegregation case? There's been segregation in a community school corporation forever and ever, amen, and somebody brings an action asking the district court for equitable relief.
Well, Your Honor,
and then are we going to apply a two-year statute of limitations? Well, you should have known for more than the last 2 years that unconstitutional condition prevailed.
Well, Your Honor, of course, this hasn't been brief, but what I would suggest is that perhaps in the hypothetical Your Honor put forward, there would be a continuing violation if the segregation continues to exist, and therefore would be within 2 years if you brought your lawsuit challenging current segregation.
Would relief be limited then to the 2 years?
Honestly, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that question.
I think it's a very troubling situation. You seem to be asking for an extraordinarily broad rule that could really impact on civil rights litigation in this country, and I don't see any principled distinction that you're asking me to draw there.
Well, I would ask this court to look to what this court, in fact, has done in prior cases and what the Supreme Court has done. And we cite the Tomanino case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case. And we also cite Savory versus Lyons, which is this court's decision. And in those cases, both brought under 1983, equitable relief, the statute of limitations applied when the plaintiff had requested equitable relief.
So those cases do tell us that in some circumstances the two-year statute's going to apply when equitable relief is in the mix or available.
Right.
But it doesn't justify the rule you're asking for.
Well, there's no reason to distinguish this case from those cases. There's no principle basis.
Why not? Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I don't see any principle reason to distinguish this particular case in which it's seeking. General Auto's claim is it can only obtain equitable relief. But, of course, and that's because the city has deferred, has not proceeded with taking the sign down yet. What we have an order right now since 1998 that says the sign is subject to removal. because of the violation of the permit requirement. Yet, because of this lawsuit, the city hasn't proceeded with that, removing the sign. And therefore, the only reason they lack a legal claim is because we have forborne our rights to relief.
In any event, with respect to both the procedural and substantive due process clauses, your position is we could reach the merits and affirm. Am I correct?
If the statute of limitation does not apply, it is our position that if you reach the merits, that
is there any law of God or man that we have to reach the statute of limitation, that we have to decide the case on the statute of limitations issue?
I can't think of any.
If the substantive due process claims fail on their merits, why would we have to decide whether those claims are subject to a statute of limitations?
Correct, Your Honor. I don't know that there would be a reason that you would have to choose one avenue or the other in order to render your decision.
It's simply an affirmative defense.
Correct, Your Honor. It's an affirmative defense.
Thank you.
But on the merits of the substantive due, I guess back on the statute of limitations, one more thing is I should say is that General Auto did not need to wait until 1998. Its position is it needed to wait to be told in 98 that WICO was not going to get a permit. But General Auto was not entitled to wait to be told the inevitable. It could tell simply by looking at the ordinances that it would not be entitled, WICO rather, would not be entitled to a permit in 1998 because sign was too close to a residence district, which it knew it should have known, and could not be grandfathered because of the 1990 grandfather provision. And moreover, WICO's 1998 permit application would not assist General Auto in claiming entitlement to legal nonconforming status in any event, and that's because for the grandfather provision to apply, the permit had to be prior to 1990, prior to the effective date of the ordinance. So General Auto could not wait while WICO pursued a 1998 permit application, because even if that permit, no matter the outcome of that permit application, it would not entitle General Auto to a permit to nonconforming status because there was no permit prior to 1990. A 1998 permit would not help. Then on the merits, I was going to skip over the procedural due process argument's merits because it's now clear after the reply brief that the procedural due process claim that General Auto is raising in this court is different than the procedural due process claim that it pled and argued and briefed below. And so its new procedural due process claim is waived. And the procedural due process claim it did pursue in the district court isn't now abandoned. This court precedent supports that result. On the First Amendment, General Auto is challenging the grandfather provision as a restriction on speech. But the grandfather provision easily satisfies the time, place, and manner test because the provision is content neutral. And that's because the way it's determined whether a sign can be grandfathered, it's not necessary to look at the content of the sign. It's only necessary to look at whether the sign had a permit. And so what the sign said now or what it said in the past is irrelevant to grandfather status. Whether the sign had a permit, in turn, does not turn on the particular sign's content because all signs are subject to the permit requirement. So it doesn't matter what the sign said, whether it had to go get a permit. All signs did. So the grandfather provision is content neutral and, more as we explain more fully in the brief, narrowly tailored to serve the significant interest that the city has in requiring permits. The city's interest in requiring permits is significant because there are tens and thousands of signs throughout the city. And we need to keep track of those signs because signs are easy to erect and easy to illuminate and easy to move without our knowledge. So that's why we have a permitting scheme. General Auto flouted that scheme back in the 1960s and 70s, and its sign flew under the radar for decades. Moreover, the grandfather provision is narrowly, besides being narrowly tailored to serve that significant interest, there are also ample alternative channels available for General Auto's speech if In fact, it is speaking because, of course, this is White Coat sign, as Your Honor previously pointed out. It's not General Otto's speech so much as it is White Coat speech. Unless there are further questions, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Layton.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Balls have? Sir, you have 2 minutes.
A couple of points I would like to touch on briefly. The city has taken the position, we feel a rather extraordinary position, that it would have been unreasonable to rely on the city's determination from its own Zoning Board of Appeals in 1998 that the wall sign constituted a legal nonconforming use. That determination was made formally by William Merritt, a longtime employee of the Zoning Department. I believe he testified at trial that he was intimately familiar with the provision 8.9 parenthetical 7 dealing with advertising signs, as well as the provision 6.7-1 dealing with nonconforming uses. It's an extraordinary position that should not be accepted by this court. With regard to the waiver statement by the City of Chicago that the procedural due process claim was waived, that is not the case. The standard is whether there were any facts alleged that could constitute a procedural due process denial. That was the case in this case, particularly for all the property interest argument that was made in conjunction with plaintiffs not being able to meaningfully participate in the administrative review action. Not just the fact that they were denied intervention, but as was later confirmed.
But you're not seeking more process here, as I understand your claim. You want your sign grandfathered. So you're not asking for more procedural due process, more hearings, more opportunity to argue your case. That's what a procedural due process claim is all about. You want your sign grandfathered. You want affirmative relief.
If this court, we ask that this court reverse the trial court's denial of a substantive due process violation and remand with directions to enter judgment in our favor on that claim. Alternatively, we believe we stated a claim for procedural due process.
What sort of remedy are you asking for in that claim?
We are asking that the dismissal be reversed and we be allowed to proceed in the trial court on that issue. Alternatively,
what sort of remedy are you seeking?
A denial of the finding that there is no legal nonconforming use.
So you want to be grandfathered?
Yes.
You're not asking for more hearings in front of the zoning authority or more process with the city council.
No.
You want affirmative relief.
That's correct. I speak only to the fact that we stated a claim.
Is there to your procedural due process claim if what you're seeking is grandfathered status and not more process?
Well, with regard to procedural due process, we weren't allowed to challenge that in any meaningful state court process. So that would be the violation.
Well, you didn't seek to intervene with the zoning authority. You didn't seek to intervene until the case was in the Cook County Circuit Court, right?
That's correct. And we included in the record the procedural rules for proceeding in front of the Zoning Board of Appeals, and there is no provision for intervention in a case before the Zoning Board of Appeals.
Well, you didn't have to actually intervene because you were the one that was served with the notice of violation, right? And then you just deferred it to your lessee.
Well,
you were a real party in interest, to use civil procedure language, if that applies in a zoning administrative context.
Yes. And
the city was going after you, and you sent White Co. in to do battle.
Well, White Co. had possession of the wall sign space under a lease. We did not have possession. But as this court noted previously, it's the plaintiffs that have a greater interest in the outcome. It's the plaintiffs that have the long-term interest in the outcome, irrespective of the fact that they had leased the wall space and had relinquished possession of the wall space under a limited-term lease.
So to the extent that you're asserting a procedural due process claim and it hasn't been forfeited or abandoned, you're seeking another opportunity with the zoning authority?
Not with the zoning authority. We're seeking an opportunity to be heard in a court, a state court, in a meaningful way. That's what we sought, and the fact that that was denied was the denial of procedural due process.
Well, what authority do we have to order the state court to reopen that matter?
Not for to reopen the state court, but to give us the relief we are requesting in finding that these ordinances are unconstitutional and are being applied in an unconstitutional fashion.
Okay. But that's your substantive claim, not your
procedural. It's also our procedural. It's also our procedural, Your Honor.
It's beating a dead horse. You can't get that kind of remedy in a procedural due process claim. All you can get is more process. You can't get the substantive relief that you're looking for. You get another chance to have a hearing and an opportunity to be heard, and et cetera.
Well, as we understand it, any meaningful process was denied to us, and we are accorded any relief that would be available under Section 1983. And we feel that this court and the district court did have authority to grant us the relief that we requested. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Waltz. The court thanks both counsel for really excellent arguments this morning, and the case will be taken under advisement.